From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Marilyn Morning. This week, former Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batts broke the silence he's kept in public since Mayor Rawlings Blake fired him 2 months ago. We asked City Councilman Brandon Scott to react to Batts' descriptions of a love fest when the City Council reviewed his contract and of police training to deal with bias. Then Tom Hall talks about the social, cultural, and political history of the gay rights movement with author and activist Louise Parker Kelly, whose new book is called LGBT Baltimore, and with longtime gay activist Kurt Decker. Plus, we kick off the Labor Day weekend with sounds from the Charm City Labor Chorus. Tom talks to its director, Daryl Moak, about singing for solidarity. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, it's Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We heard this week from former Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batts for the first time since Mayor Rawlings Blake fired him July 8th. Batts and two others spoke to nearly 600 students at a panel discussion Wednesday evening about justice in America at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg. He introduced himself to the students as Dr. Anthony Batts. He holds a doctorate in public administration and immediately zeroed in on the story of 2 months ago.
Well, July 8th, I was fired for the first time in my life from a job that I took as police commissioner. Now, it's one thing to be fired, and you see you guys putting your hands up in embarrassment that comes along with that. It's another thing to be fired and know about internationally. So I had friends in the UK who called and said, "Dude, I just saw you on the BBC. You got fired. Thank you for telling me. I appreciate that."
We thought you'd be interested in hearing some of the points Anthony Batts made at the college, and we thought it would be useful at the same time to get the view of someone with a community perspective on Batts' 3 years heading Baltimore's police force. City Councilman Brandon Scott, who represents the 2nd District and is vice chair of the council's Public Safety Committee, joins us by phone. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back, Sheila.
So let's listen to how Anthony Batts described his contract review by the City Council.
This time last year, I went for an extension of my contract as a police commissioner of Baltimore. It was a love fest. Council people applauding the work that we as a department did. At the end of 2014, just 9 months ago, I got a $22,000 a year raise for the work that the police department did. By every metric on a police department that you look at, with the exception of one, we hit a home run. We dropped crime in every category. Felony crime, misdemeanor crime, every category that you measure in law enforcement today, we dropped it and we had negative numbers. We did excellent in every category by every metric that you can imagine, with the exception of one: public trust. And public trust in Baltimore was an issue the day that I walked in. Public trust in Baltimore, I would say, was an issue 10 years before that.
Councilman Scott, how do you remember his session with the City Council?
I remember being positive. I would never categorize it as a love fest. As many folks don't know, that 2014 and what you see publicly is not always what happens in private meetings behind closed doors. But 2014, to my knowledge, is the second best year as far as violent crime and homicides in the city on record. But for me, as I often say, and I said it to Commissioner Batts when he was here, any year that is not better than 2011 to me is a failure. Once you've had the best, better isn't as good. So last year, although we made great progress last year, and yes, it was all these historical lows, they were not the lowest ever. So once you've had the best, better isn't as good. So for me, yes, you know, people should have been happy, somewhat happy. How can you be but so happy about 200 and plus something people dying in a city? We should be somewhat acknowledging the progress as we were, but no one was out dancing around and celebrating and heralding Anthony Batts as the next best thing since sliced bread. That was taking it a little too far for me. I had issues constantly with Commissioner Batts. I agree with him constantly on different issues, but not all the time do we have to always be at odds publicly. Not all the time that we have to be praising a person. Look, you deal with a person in that kind of position, issue the issue, thing by thing, time by time, email by email, phone call by phone call. You can't take this work too personally. You can't let emotions and your feelings about someone get involved in it. You have to deal with the work as the work, and that's how I do. I can only speak for myself. We can be the greatest teammates on one issue and be the greatest opponents on the next. That's just how it is when you're in service, especially when you're talking about the lives and safeties of citizens.
And what are your thoughts in that clip we just heard? Councilman, former Commissioner Batt seems to point to public trust in police as an intractable issue.
No doubt about it. Public trust has been an issue for the Baltimore Police Department longer than the 31 years that Brandon Scott has been on this earth, and it's going to take a lot of work by a lot of different people to get that public trust back. That's not something that I can totally blame on Anthony Bass. I could say that Anthony Bass helped in some ways with public trust. I could say that Anthony Bass hurt in some ways with public trust. But it's not something that I can put on him. But what I can put on him is that what you don't hear, you did not hear in that statement, you did not hear in some of the other statements, is self-responsibility. I myself take responsibility for stuff that has happened in the city over the last few months, that happened in 2014, that continues to happen in our city every day. And when you're the leader of an organization whose directive is to make sure the citizens are safe, and you're no longer that leader, and it seems that you're just blaming on everyone but yourself, that's not what I call leadership. And that's the big thing for me. If you start off by saying, listen, I did not do X, Y, and Z. When I wake up in the morning, I don't worry about what Anthony Batts or Kevin Davis or Stephanie Rawlins-Blake or Jack Young or Barack Obama is doing to make my city a better place. The first thing I do is, what am I doing and what am I not doing? And that's what true leadership is about. It's not blaming it on someone else. It's not blaming it on everyone else. What am I doing about all these great issues that he brought up? What am I doing to make those issues go away or make them better?
That's City Councilman Brandon Scott here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're reviewing some of the comments former Police Commissioner Anthony Batts made at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg on Wednesday. Councilman, I'd like to get your reaction to Commissioner Batts saying that Baltimore police, quote, took a knee after the riot in Baltimore, which I guess means police paused. He said police felt that he was not standing up for them. He pointed to Washington, D.C., the vote of no confidence against the police chief there. And he questioned whether police unions essentially are allowing surges in crime as a way of getting chiefs they disagree with out of office.
Listen, we all know what happened. And yes, you can say that there were some officers who were quote unquote taking it easy or not being as aggressive if they were before. But at the end of the day, even during all the craziness, I had officers in my area, in my district, who were following up on 911 calls and pulling over people who had just robbed people with guns. So I think, one, it depends on where you were in the city, and two, the overwhelming majority of police officers have too much pride in their work to just not do anything. So, but if you're looking at it from his viewpoint, from his standpoint, and what you have to really dig deep down into is the quote-unquote stand-down order. Was there one given? Wasn't it one given? Who said to give it? And things like that. If, again, this is, goes back to that self-responsibility thing. If I'm the police commissioner at that time, I can did all that in the order by just saying, look, this is what happened, this is what I said, this is what I did, this is what I have to do to rebuild those relationships. Instead, what we saw was an ongoing media battle, and this is what I was talking about at the time, that an ongoing media battle where the leader of the organization was arguing with the troops in the organization and others about what happened, and that's not leadership. That's something that high school girls do. Grown men should not be having arguments with each other about how to work together in the media. They should be having that discussion. If you're the leader, if someone calls and yells and screams and goes on TV and talks about Brandon Scott and how they want to work with me but I refuse to, I'm going to call them and say, come to my office, let's figure it out. I'm not going to go back and forth with them on TV. I'm not going to go back and forth with them on social media because that benefits no one. And the loser in all of this are the citizens of Baltimore, because while these petty arguments was going on and the leader is someone who kept going back and forth having press conferences about what the FOP is saying, the FOP is saying what they believe. And if you're the leader of that organization, you have to sit down and talk to them to get to a point where what they believe and what you believe, we can figure out some sense of a middle area to work together, because that's what we have to do. The bickering just has to stop.
I'm also curious in your reaction to this summary from former Commissioner Batts about Baltimore police and whether they're trained to compensate for bias. Let's listen to that.
Everyone has a bias. Everyone in this room has a bias. Every police officer that comes to the table has a bias. I have biases, and they're from where I come from and who I am as a whole. But what we started teaching now, and we started in the Baltimore Police Department a year ago, is a class that focuses on, number one, understanding your bias, knowing that your bias is there. Don't ignore your bias, but be a professional. So you don't get paid to voice your biases. You don't get paid to act on your biases. You get paid to be a professional.
Councilman Scott, how does it seem to you, from your observation, are Baltimore police trained well to compensate for their bias?
I think that that's one of the things that Commissioner Batts and I actually agree on. I think that that's bigger than Baltimore police. That's humans in general, and especially in America. We all have illicit biases. We all bring those to the table, and we have to be trained to get beyond them. And this is something that I've been saying even before Commissioner Batts came here. So if I'm a police officer and I'm coming from Western Pennsylvania or Southern Maryland or from Baltimore County, I'm going to come in with this notion about young black men in particular, because in America, there's billions of dollars that are spent every year to say that young black males in America are big, bad, scary things. So even if they're the nicest person in the world, in the back of their mind, they've already been poisoned on that. What we have to do as a culture is break down those biases, but we also have to fight it from the other end and fight those media outlets and all these people who are pumping these images not only to these individuals, but to the young black males themselves who are now being poisoned and think that their ceiling is so limited to what they can do because of what society tells them.
I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilman Brandon Scott is the city councilman of the 2nd District in Baltimore. Anthony Batts, who was fired as Baltimore Police Commissioner 2 months ago, spoke to students at Mount St. Mary's University on Wednesday night, along with Bishop Dennis Madden of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Baltimore and Mark Maurer of the national advocacy group The Sentencing Project. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. A few more excerpts from Anthony Batts also. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, the history of the gay rights movement in Baltimore. Stay tuned to 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us on this Labor Day weekend. In 2012, Maryland became the first state to pass a same-sex marriage bill by voter referendum. Earlier this summer, the tide toward marriage equality shifted decidedly when the Supreme Court ruled that all states must allow gay marriage. Now, a conversation about the history of the gay rights movement in Baltimore in the decades leading up to these major developments. In a new book in Arcadia Publishing's series of pictorial histories, the author and activist Louise Parker Kelly chronicles the social, cultural, and political story of Baltimore's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. The book is called LGBT Baltimore. Louise Parker Kelly joins me in the studio, along with Kurt Decker, civil rights lawyer who is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. He's been a gay activist in Baltimore and on the national scene for more than 30 years. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello,
and,
Tom.
And Kurt, it's good to have you back. And Louise, it's nice to meet you. So Louise, you talk about three transformative moments in the LGBT scene in Baltimore. What are the three sort of milestones here in Baltimore?
I would say the first milestone is probably in 1975 when Baltimore Gay Alliance began, and possibly Metropolitan Community Church in 1972. Those two were organizations, so there was somewhere for people to go who were out. But the next thing that happened was that there became a national conversation that affected Baltimore, so that people were able to come out. And come out became a phrase that everybody used in all kinds of contexts later. But it was the biggest step, I think, that the community took. And it was a big deal in Baltimore because it was a conservative, blue-collar, very heavily Catholic city. So, for example, when we first went to get the rights bill passed in 1979, Archbishop Borders.
This is a city ordinance that passed, but took three tries.
Yeah. Right. To amend the civil rights legislation that was already in place to add sexual orientation. And Archbishop Borders decided that it was not okay with him, and he came out against it. And that was one of the first waves of political organization that woke everybody up, because the expectation was that, oh, well, many cities have passed this, so Baltimore will. And then people became more organized. GLCC began. GLCCB is the Gay and Lesbian Community Center of Baltimore. Has a lot more initials now, but that's the way people usually refer to it. And when it began in 1977, we had lots of services suddenly. A switchboard for people who were coming out, especially gay youth who were very much at risk. The STD clinic was part of the community center. It's now the Chase Brexton Clinic. The gay paper, and just endless numbers of groups that became support groups. Mm-hmm. And we also had fun. We had drag shows. We had Halloween parties. We were able to find each other.
And Kurt Decker, back in 1980, you helped organize a fundraiser for the Gay Community Center. And this business that Louise is talking about, with people gradually coming out in larger numbers, back in the 70s and the early 80s, it was not such an easy thing for gay people to do.
Absolutely. I think younger people today forget, with all of the attention and public media on gay and bisexual and transgender issues, that back in the late 70s, 80s, even though, as Louise said, there were this beginning of all these services, there was still an incredible amount of fear. We had that first fundraiser in 1980, sold a lot of tickets, and when people approached the aquarium, there were Klieg lights and press to film it, and many of the people just turned away and went home. They just couldn't really bring themselves to go into that kind of public limelight yet. And of course, that was, you know, the very beginnings of trying to get people to feel comfortable that we had to organize and be seen in order to achieve our rights.
As the AIDS crisis grew in the early 80s through the 90s, that actually had an interesting effect on people's willingness to come out. More people started coming out as the AIDS crisis became more and more part of the public consciousness.
Yes, AIDS really was a very transformative, devastating, and yet almost in an ironic way, an organizing tool. You couldn't avoid coming out when you and your friends, you know, then developed this at first unknown disease, and then as it became clear that it was HIV, and all of the stigma and potential discrimination that would come from that really forced a lot of us to become much more public and much more organized.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes it was personal. I was going to funerals all the time, and I said to myself, I can't just sit in the newspaper office and put in obituaries. I have to go, and I ended up doing work
and
for I was,
Hero. You were working at the gay paper.
I was working at the AIDS administration, but then I worked for Hero, and Hero was one of the first organizations in the country. That was 1984 that they began.
I was involved in both Governor Hughes's and Governor Schaefer's AIDS commissions, and we were faced with many people wanting to do mandatory testing. And we were concerned that if we went down that road, which may have been a good public health effort, it did mean that people would then be subject to possible discrimination. And so that sort of energized us to say we've got to build in protections. It made the gay rights ordinance that eventually passed in 1980 a really essential piece of legislation because of the ever-growing stigma and discrimination that people were facing, whether you had HIV or not.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the third try to get that legislation passed? And see what was the thing that tipped the balance?
Well, the first thing we did was decide, since Stu Burns decided he was going to lie and not support the bill when he said he would, is that we needed to get a candidate that we could trust. And so a lot of lesbian and gay people went out to work for Kurt Schmoke's election through the Lesbian and Gay Democratic Club and through other means, and to get Mary Pat Clark back in there and as president of the city council. But we also did this sophisticated lobbying effort that we'd never done before because people were energized. The 1987 March on Washington brought a new energy to everybody. They just got fed up. And also, we had a great time making fun of the bigots because, for example, there was Mimi DiPietro on the Baltimore City Council, and he was talking about, we got good gays in Baltimore. They don't want this bill. And we would just look at each other and be stunned. He was in an elevator with Ann Gordon, who was a member of the Justice Campaign. And he looked at her and he said, see them gays? And she looked back at him and said, I am them gays. And he said, good people, good people.
We had the
time, people just didn't want to be like Mimi DiPietro. They didn't want to show up like that.
We had the unique ability to bring together three very disparate groups to oppose this bill, black Muslims, Orthodox, Jewish community, and evangelicals. I think it's the only time they ever came together.
It's quite the coalition, isn't
it? Yes. and we did have it was a very sophisticated campaign, but it wasn't up until the very last minute because I remember Mary Pat Clark telling me that on the very last day when we had been through two readers, the Catholic Church had weighed in. It's been passed twice.
If you get to the third reader, pretty sure you're going to get the bill.
You should be in. But it did take, I have to say, that it took a lot of political courage, again, in 1988 from those members of the city council. And as Louise said, led by Mary Pat Clark. And we knew we had Kurt Schmoke's promise to sign the bill. So that actually gave an impetus. Most legislators aren't going to vote for something they know is not going to pass. They're not going to put their neck on the line. And so having Kurt's support allowed us to go back to those individual members and say, yes, you're taking a very serious political risk, but it's going to pay off.
And we also had people coming in and being bigoted and showing their hatred and spewing it all over the city council. And the city council members were sitting there going, we don't need to see proof that there's bias against LGBT people because they're doing it right in front of us.
Louise Parker Kelly is the author of a new book on the history of the gay rights movement called LGBT Baltimore. Kurt Decker is with us in the studio as well. He's the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network and a longtime gay rights activist in Baltimore and beyond. Kurt, you were involved right from the very beginning with a study out of Hopkins called SHARE, the study to help AIDS research efforts. Began in 1982. Tell about how this was organized and what the purpose of this study, which is still ongoing.
Yes, Dr. Frank Polk, a fantastic researcher who has since passed away, approached me in 1982 and said that he'd gotten a grant from the NIH to try to figure out what was happening to these gay men across the country who were dying from an unexplained series of diseases. And
this is before people were aware of HIV,
yes,
and the causes of AIDS, etc.
HIV wasn't really identified till 1985, and we were well into the study by then. And so he asked me to help him find 1,200 gay men to participate in the study, which was daunting in a city like Baltimore. Just to give you an example, we had asked Frank to take the study to Union Memorial, the sports clinic, as a way of making people feel more comfortable. They initially agreed, and when the House resident doctors heard that there was going to be this gay health study, they reneged on the contract. And so we ended up going back to Hopkins, where that study has gone on.
And this will continue,
yes,
for the foreseeable future, right?
Yes, it's turned out it was one of the first studies to identify HIV. And it was an interesting position because Dr. Polk came to us and said, I know the HIV status of everybody in this study, what do I do with that information? And it was a pretty difficult discussion about whether you shared this information with people when there was no treatment or potential cure at that time.
And what did they decide?
We decided that people should have the right to know. I would say in retrospect, I think now we realize that probably we should have mandated that people be told because of the ability to transmit it. But we were, again, in that very incredible period of the balance between discrimination and information.
Mm-hmm. And Louise Parker Kelly, you write about the communities of color who were involved in the gay rights movement. What have been the particular challenges for them?
I had a personal experience of it because I was part of GLCCB, and every so often we
would have... That's the Gay and Lesbian Community
Center. Yes, the Gay and Lesbian Community Center. And every so often we would have an election, and the men would look around at each other and say, oh, we don't have enough people of color. We don't have enough women. And they'd turn to me and say, go find us some candidates in the community. Now, there were always people, always, all along at the community center who were people of color, who were leaders and participating. But every once in a while, there didn't seem to be enough people. And I finally got fed up one day because John turned to me. John was the president and said, you know, we really do need to have somebody from the black community as a delegate at large. Could you go find someone? And I said, John, why don't you go look in your living room? And if you don't have anybody there, what does that say? Because I don't want to keep doing this. We need to create relationships. And to his credit and to the credit of many of the men that worked at the community center, they did that. But I think the black gay community in Baltimore was faced with the double whammy, and the people who stepped forward were among some of the strongest and most impressive people I have ever met.
Kurt Decker, you have worked for the last three decades or more as the head of the disability the largest advocacy organization for disability rights. It's an interesting intersection between rights of the disabled and rights of the LGBT community. And moving forward, a lot of people have commented, for example, with the Supreme Court decision. What's the next step for the gay community as we move forward from this Supreme Court decision earlier this summer?
I do believe that the next step has to be then building in this protection of discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodation, as Baltimore did in 1988. I mean, I think it's important to realize that Baltimore was actually in the forefront of doing this along with some other cities. But it wasn't until just a few years ago that the state passed that kind of non-discrimination bill. And now that we need to expand that at a national level. Because as you said, now that people are free to get married and come out, that actually can put them at risk. And we're seeing stories across the country where teachers and other people are losing their jobs by virtue of getting married. And so we want to make sure that potential of that victory isn't sullied by, you know, further discrimination.
And then people were told, like Maggie McIntosh, Maggie McIntosh helped pass the bill. She was told, don't step out on this issue, marriage equality. It'll cost you the election. You know, Mary Washington faced the same thing. It's a sensation that people have that if we are upfront about, yes, we need national protection, then you, as a politician, could lose your job.
And I think the other forefront now is transgendered issues and sexual identity issues, which are related and need to be addressed as well. And it is interesting to see how quickly public opinion is changing in this very fast social media world.
Many gains and with a rapidity that probably nobody could have predicted 5 years ago even. This book is a terrific read and it's got some beautiful
photographs.
It's a nice
beginning.
Yeah.
There's lots more to be told.
All right. Well, thanks to you both. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Kurt Decker is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. He's been active in the gay rights movement locally and nationally for many years. Louise Parker Kelly is the author of a new book in the Images of Modern America series. It's published by Arcadia Publishing. The book is called LGBT Baltimore, and we've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. After a break, some sounds from the Charm City Labor Chorus.
Oh, yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show. There is power in the
factory. And welcome back, everybody. Good to have you with us. I'm Tom Hall on Maryland Morning. As we begin this Labor Day weekend, I'd like to let you know about a group of local progressive activists who combine their passion for union and community organizing with a love of singing. The Charm City Labor Chorus was formed 7 years ago to sing songs of the labor movement and to raise awareness about historic and contemporary issues of social justice. Their director is Daryl L.C. Moak, and he joins me in the studio. It's great to meet you.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Tom.
So the chorus was founded in 2008 by Pam Parker.
Yes.
Tell us what the animating principles behind the chorus are.
We've evolved a little over time. Primarily, there are lots of labor choruses around the country, and Pam, having been singing with the D.C. Labor Chorus for a while, felt that Baltimore had enough of its own activism and enough action and enough stuff going on, enough need for social justice, that there was plenty to sing about right here at home.
So this is part of a movement across the country. There are many of these, I guess.
There are lots of labor choruses and other kinds of progressive singing ensembles and mm-hmm. groups that are out there from the folk tradition. A lot of them grew out of the folk tradition. So we've taken songs that are gospel songs and we call them repurposing them for the movement. And so we've taken popular songs, Broadway show tunes, all kinds of music that can be adapted. Either the message is already inherent in the words and the music, or we like it so much that we can make some alterations in some of the lyrics and make it, bring it forward to a community of folks from across all different genders and races and spectrums and sexual orientation and races and class, and who are concerned about making things better.
And who's singing with you? Where do these folks come from? Are they come from the activist community?
You know, our singers are coming from all over. They're people who love to sing. And we are a chorus that is evolving generationally. So we are now attracting even more younger folks to our organization. And we have, in fact, every concert, for the last few concerts, we've had young people who are either related to or somehow heard about us by members of the chorus, grandkids or kids. Our community neighbors are coming and they're singing in the concerts with us. So we're inviting them to sing with us throughout the year at this point. But they're coming from unions. They're coming from progressive organizations. They're coming from activist organizations. They're coming just from the grassroots people who are just rising up and saying enough is enough. And we've got to sing about it because that's one of the ways that we can contribute to change.
And your background, obviously you have an activist and social justice background. What's your musical and arts background?
I'm a theater arts person by training and preparation and by natural, I guess, interest. So I do theater and I do a lot of choreo-dramatic work. I'm a dance and sing and acting as well as directing and writing and, you know, that kind of thing. So I've done a lot of things since I graduated from the High School of the Arts in Los Angeles, LA County High School for the Arts, and have an MFA in theater and undergrad in dance and theater, along with my mental health background and ministry. I'm in ministry. So I do a lot of things that all coalesced together at some point into how do we make something that makes a difference in the world. And so my art, my ministry, my activism, and my advocacy work, even my political work, all speak to that.
We have a little clip of you singing a duet with Leah Gilmore, and this is a tune called None of Us Are Free.
Oh, wow.
Well, you better listen, sisters and brothers, because if you do, you can hear. There are voices still calling out from across the years. Hey, where they're crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land.
You need to tell.
And they will until we all come to understand. Hey, none of us are free.
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 None of us are free. none of us is chained. None of us
so the chorus, and Leah Gilmore, by the way, a good friend of mine and
she's
a good friend
awesome.
Of our
she's
program.
Amazing.
She's been on the program many times. You do a lot of service to the community, to the labor movement. I mean, you perform at important events. Give us an idea of the kinds of places, the kinds of venues that you're performing at.
We've performed for the Viva House and those folks that are a part of that institution. We've performed for the Soul Kitchen when we have a concert coming up, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. We've performed at Morgan.
Yeah, that's going to be on the 19th of
September,
the month. Yeah.
Later this month. And we have performed for unions at rallies and we've done a community sing. We've done something at the Creative Alliance before. We did some teaching and sing-alongs around labor songs.
Of course, there's an incredible repertoire of great labor songs. I mean, people think about Solidarity Forever, Joe Hill, the Woody Guthrie canon, etc. Here's a clip of you guys singing a very famous tune, I'm Sticking to the Union. So I wonder, are there lots of composers now, writing contemporary progressive songs for the movement? I mean, clearly there's a big canon of old songs. How about the new scene?
There's a lot of folks. Anne Feeney, of course, continues to write and continues to perform. One of my favorites is Joe Jenks. Another one of my favorites is the Fruit of Labor Ensemble, and we're just here in August with the United Electrical Workers in their national conference, and we sang with them. And so there are those folks. A lot of music, if you listen to popular music, still has a very progressive message to it. It's usually done by solo artists, and so we would have to sort of repurpose some of that music to make it more choral. But our chorus is not, the typical just sort of choral singing as much as it is an ensemble. And my vision for the organization is that we would become more of a performance ensemble. So our audiences will be excited to see more theatrical, more dance, more spectacle. To bring to life the messages that we're trying to bring.
And you have a big following. You did a concert last spring at the BMA. It was sold out.
The chorus members were surprised. I wasn't surprised. I anticipated that we would be pretty sold out, if not completely, but very, very close to it. We had been performing at Morgan for several years, and we had been filling up that space. And I just knew that, as soon as we get to a larger space, we'd fill it up. People really are hungry for something else other than the traditional music that is just sort of doom and gloom. They want something that's going to lift their spirits. They want something to inspire them and to remind them of why they are who they are and why we do what we do. And so I think that's what we do. And people are looking for that, something to brighten up their lives and leave out with a tune in their head that will encourage them to keep fighting.
Well, Daryl Moak, great to meet you, and happy Labor Day.
Thank you so much. Happy Labor Day.
Daryl Moak is the director of the Charm City Labor Chorus. They rehearse on Tuesday nights at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in downtown Baltimore. If you're interested in learning more about the chorus, come on over to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll have a link to more information. That's it for us this morning. Coming up Monday on the Labor Day edition of Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast, former Congressman Barney Frank talks about his recent autobiography, and political scientist Thomas Schaller discusses his book about the Republican Party's hold on the U.S. Congress. That's coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you have a great holiday weekend.
Carries on. Love carries. Love carries.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at zekescoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1862, General Robert E. Lee began to move his Army of Northern Virginia across the Potomac, the so-called Maryland Campaign. Officers of both armies later said they were surprised by the strength of pro-Union sentiment in the area around Frederick. Lee's invasion of the North was repulsed within 2 weeks in the bloodiest day in American military history, the Battle of Antietam. We're back on Monday, Labor Day. Please join us.
I won't sleep. Keep the radio on. I won't sleep. Keep the radio on. Will you be my friend into the middle of the night? I won't sleep. Keep the radio on.